Welcome to Dear Skylar, where I talk to all kinds of interesting people about topics I'm asked about as a transgender educator and activist, things like gender, sexuality, race, sports, mental health, and so many things in between and beyond. I'm asked about masculinity a lot, and really, I think about it all the time as well. I often joke that my life is like a gender studies class, and I recently have been thinking a lot about masculinity and sort of manhood in general in conjunction with mental health. Andrew Tate, who you might have heard of, has recently lost his appeal against house arrest in Romania as the case against his human trafficking continues. If you don't know, Andrew Tate is a divisive social media personality, a former professional kickboxer who was charged in Romania with rape, human trafficking, and forming a criminal gang to sexually exploit women. So not the most fantastic guy. But he has a lot of followers, and again, most of them are young boys. And many of them see him as a sort of icon. Tate rose to fame through his, quote, self-improvement advice for, again, mostly male fans, and a self-described misogynist. He compares women to dogs, says women shouldn't be allowed to drive, and claims that men should have authority over their female partners. In many ways, he speaks to that insecure teenage boy who doesn't know where he belongs, who is just trying to figure out his own manhood, who, in some ways, in this world, doesn't know where his place is. And Tate tells him if he just works hard and disregards all the women in his life, he can be successful. According to the director of research at American University's Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab, Pashta Dashgard, Tate's rhetoric appeals to boys who feel forgotten or left out of the cultural conversation that has now embraced and popularized feminism. The director Dashgard says this, "There are a lot of boys who are like, I don't see how I fit into this. And I don't understand how feminist concepts apply to me, except as a way of criticizing me or diminishing me. That gap creates space for grifters and scam artists and people who have bad intentions to insert themselves into the conversation. Andrew Tate is a part of a long legacy of shock jocks and people who make their money being offensive." And again, as a transgender man myself, I think about manhood, I think, a lot. And especially when I'm reading about Andrew Tate and reading about the boys who follow him or who aspire to be like him, I can see where they're getting lost. And I can see where somebody like Andrew Tate or Jordan Peterson or Donald Trump or Ron DeSantis, right, all of these men who are really irresponsibly wielding their power and social capital, I can see where young boys are attaching to these kinds of men. Because in a lot of ways, the cultural conversation has shifted to prioritize feminism. But the thing that's getting lost in how this categorizes feminism and recent cultural conversations about social justice is it doesn't mean that we should be pushing away men. It's that everybody needs to be held more accountable, especially those in power, which is largely men and white men. But this is a delicate conversation and a complicated conversation. And I wanted to address a very central question that has come up in my mind often, and it's come up in a lot of conversations that I've had, especially with other men, specifically cis men, specifically white cis men in my life. So the question that we're going to address today on this episode of Dear Skylar is, what do we do with all of these angry white men? To help me answer this question, I spoke with Austrian swimmer and two-time Olympic medalist, world record holder, and current psychologist, Dr. Marcus Rogan. Dr. Rogan and I actually have a few things in common. We grew up in the same county in Fairfax County, Virginia, about a decade apart. We also even swam for the same team growing up. And we're both interested in psychology. I studied psychology in school too, though I'm not a licensed psychologist like he is. Dr. Rogan was also the director of performance psychology for the Brazilian Olympic team in 2016. And now he runs his own private practice doing experiential performance psychology. All of this is to say, not only is Dr. Rogan a very impressive person, but he's also worked with a lot of men, and a lot of men athletes, and a lot of men in difficult moments with their mental health. For these reasons, I think he's the perfect person to help us talk about this topic. Without further ado, here is our conversation.
Marcus, I'm so excited to be here in your office, actually, your beautiful leather chairs and in California, where you live. Thank you so much for having me here.
Thank you for coming. It means a lot to me.
I'm so excited to have this conversation. So you and I met, I want to say it was like 4 or 5 years ago at the pool at UCLA. I was here over a winter break or something training with masters. And I was just wondering, like, if you could if you remember that day at all, you like could say about, because it was such an interesting experience for me. Because anyways, I want to hear what you have to say, and then I want to reflect on it.
I remember, and maybe this speaks to some of my arrogance, but in master swimming, I'm usually the fastest. And then this guy shows up and is like, who's that? He's faster, you know? And that was really painful for me, you know, because, yeah. And then I talked to MP, mm-hmm, our mutual mm-hmm. friend, out of, yeah. MP Delisle, right? Mm-hmm. She said, oh, that's Skylar. And then I'd heard about you, but I'd never seen you, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm, so I was like, oh, that makes mm-hmm. sense. Okay, and then let's race. Mm-hmm. And then we did, and I think we did what I actually really, really enjoy. I actually don't enjoy swimming like way ahead of everybody all the time. So mm-hmm. I really enjoy close, intense races. Mm-hmm. And I do think that is, in many ways, one of the most, it's not that intimate, but really a beautiful way for men to relate to each other. Mm. Like sweating together, racing together, mm-hmm. fighting together, breathing hard together. Mm-hmm. I think is, for me, is an essential part of my experience mm-hmm. of life. And like maybe one of the last places where I can safely express my anger. Because there are very few places where I could say to anyone, right, mm-hmm. like, fuck you, let's go. I probably said that to you 10 times that morning, you know? And then again, when we swam together at your pool at Harvard, mm-hmm, and then mm-hmm. I think we swam again sometime here mm-hmm. In California. So that's, I just love that way we started a relationship with that yeah. experience.
Yeah, I remember we were doing a kick set, and I've always had like this big shoulder problem. So kicking is like the thing that I feel the best at. And we did a mm-hmm. kick set, and it was one where we had fins on as well. And it was hard because my arrogance as well, I hadn't expected master swimming to be mm-hmm. that difficult. And usually yeah. I'm also one of the faster swimmers there. But once I saw you, I'd actually seen your name before. Actually, I went and found that I have your signature on an old t-shirt of mine from an old swim meet when I was like 12. Uh-huh. And wow. you signed an old shirt of mine uh-huh. way back uh-huh. when, which I thought was so fun that I went back and like, so I had known of you, but, obviously I hadn't met you in person in that mm-hmm. way. And so I remember swimming and just having a lot of fun. Like that practice is just like one of the funnest practices in my memory.
Yeah.
And then after that, you know, we had talked a bit about my work, and we talked a bit about trans inclusion, and began a friendship essentially from there. Yeah. I'm curious. So like I said, I know a little bit about you, but I'm curious if you could share a little bit, you know, your name, your pronouns, mm-hmm. a one line bio or several line bio for our listeners who yeah. might not know who you are.
So I'm Marcus Rogan. My pronouns are he, him. And I'm legally a psychologist. But what I'm really trying to do is practice to be a good father, and a good husband, and to give my children the experience I didn't have. Mm-hmm. And I do that in many ways. I don't know if I should say this out loud, but I think I have an incredible amount of deep, meaningful relationships with my patients, but I use every single one of my experience with my patients mm-hmm. to try to become more authentic, more present, more engaged with my children. And to be more present, more engaged, and a better lover for my wife. That's what I try to do every day.
I think that's beautiful. Has it always been that way? Did you start, like, did you become a no. therapist? Yeah.
No. I wanted to be famous, make a shit ton of money, and just do that until it turns out that makes you absolutely miserable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was very lucky that right out of college, I won 2 Olympic medals, and I'm from a very small country where that was a huge deal, you know, and I made, you know, this is like 20 years ago, right? So, but I made $1 million a year out of college, and it was just crazy. And was, I had as high as a recognition rate as the chancellor of Austria, my home country. And I ran around behaving like a complete idiot. Which at first was really fun. And if you do that, right, as a cisgender white male with a lot of money at that age with Olympic medals, no one says anything, right? It was before Me Too. It was before, it was in Europe, right? It was before any form of constraints on white males, right? Mm-hmm. So I really had no limits. Like the police would pull me over and apologize. You know, it was ridiculous.
Right.
You know? But then of course it caught up with me. Like you can only get away with so many things for so long. And after about 5 years of doing that, where I still had, I had quite some success swimming. But then I really underperformed at the 2009 World Championships and got absolutely drunk, probably more drunk than I've ever been, and got kicked out of a nightclub. I climbed back in because I'm Marcus, I can do that, right? But I had forgotten that I was not in my home country, but instead in Italy, where no one gives a shit about me. And if you ever want to know what semi-professional boxers do who don't make it on the world stage, they're bouncers at nightclubs at night, and they use anyone who behaves like an idiot as practice. And I ended up in a police office after that. So I was in a hospital for a little while, then in a police office with my lawyers, and realized I had no friends who I wasn't also paying. And I was like, what the fuck kind of life am I living? And it was this big scandal in luckily a very small country, but still it was very, very painful for me to realize that I'd lived a life of like empty bullshit, more or less, of believing that if only you date like Miss Universe finalists and drive a Ferrari and live in fancy places and go all over, that that's what life is about. And to see how fake that is, and to see how quickly people are very happy to take that away from you, you know, when you, well, you fuck up, right? Like I'm not playing anyone else. So I hid for about 3 months at like the last friend I had at his apartment in New York City, where that was probably one of the happiest times in my life, because no one, like in New York City, right? Well, maybe you, because you're kind of known in America, but no one knows me in America. So it was really awesome. The only people who recognized me were Austrian tourists, right? So, but just to be anonymous.
Right,
and then I was like, okay, that's better for me. That's healthier for me. And then I started working with a very good psychologist. And after a couple of years of that, I was like, maybe that's something I want to do. And my parents, my mother's a psychiatrist, my father's a psychologist, or my stepfather's a psychologist. They said, oh, okay. Finally, maybe. And then, you know, went to the graduate school and, you know, got licensed and all that stuff.
I really appreciate you sharing all of that and sort of being that vulnerable with us as well, and kind of walking through how that journey came to be. What I want to, just like jump right into this topic, because you've already sort of named it in many ways. In a point of your life, you were sort of at the pinnacle of privilege as somebody who was an athlete, like you said, white, cisgender, male.
Yeah.
You experienced a bit of sort of a social falling, if you will, through the police incident. Yeah. And you and I have actually talked about this a little bit before. We were just talking about it when you came in, about the concept of what it means to be a cisgender white man in this world now, which is different from what it was 30 years ago, 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Definitely different from 100 years ago. And kind of what's like, I'm trying to think of the central question really, but so
I think, what do we do with all these angry white men?
Yeah.
I think that's the real question. Like, what the fuck should we do? Cause they're here.
Yeah.
You know, and they're following Andrew Tate and they're voting Donald Trump.
Yeah. They are digging their heels, you know, in the more, and I've interfaced with a lot of these kinds of guys, especially when I'm doing the work that I do. They don't want to talk about privilege, and it's scary to talk about privilege. And I always have
Have privilege. I earned it.
Right. I earned it. Which is a lot of entitlement, but that's aside the point. What you were saying just a moment ago, before we started the podcast, was this concept of social decline and how regardless of from where you are declining, it's painful.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I found being on a men's team, being perceived in the world as a cisgender man, even though I'm not one, is that it is this period of time is painful for cisgender men, especially the white ones, especially the straight ones, because the world is not creating space. Actually, they are taking away space. And even though the word you used earlier with me was share, even though cisgender white men have to share, it doesn't feel like that. It feels like things are being taken. So I love your question that you just posed is what about all these angry white men? What do we do with them?
Yeah.
I'm curious, before we answer that, what have you noticed about sort of the behavior, this phenomenon, if you will, mm-hmm. of what's happening to cisgender white men as they are being asked to share.
Okay, so what's happening today to them as they're being asked to share? First, yeah. is that like, what? You know, mm-hmm. like shock, and then surprise, and then anger. It's pretty straightforward. And then come these very aggressive behaviors, sometimes violence, often violence, or often violence towards women, often like sometimes it's just all the troll and haters online. There's right. a lot. Like I think yeah. it's like I think there should be like a checkbox. Are you currently angry cisgender white male? Like check. Okay, just you know. That's one thing. And I think this is where it becomes really clinical, right? If it's violence, it's a police matter, right? But where I often get involved is when it becomes very self-sabotaging, right? When they turn to drugs, when they turn to self-harm, when they turn to suicide or suicide attempts, right?
Right.
And that happens a lot.
Right. Well, and the most common demographic of people to attempt suicide in the country is middle-aged white men. Right. That's the actual, like the statistic.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Sure. So the uh-huh. most common demographic with race and with gender put in together is cisgender white men.
Yeah.
Between the ages of 40 and 55. And yeah. We can check the statistics to be exactly sure, but yeah. that's what I last
I think
read.
That I would add to that statistics. If they recently lost a job. Like I know if there's a man above 40, a cisgender white man who walks in to my office, who's older than 40, who just got a divorce and just lost his job, I'm basically hospitalizing him because that is ticks all the boxes.
Yeah. yeah.
Or for a suicide attempt.
Yeah.
Because they do it differently than some, you know, some suicide attempts you can argue, was it suicide? Was it cry for help? Was it maybe both? Right. Mm-hmm. This breed of men, right. They buy a gun, they drive out in the desert, and they research to make sure they don't miss, and then they shoot themselves, right? It's not like where someone could find them or where they could get interrupted or maybe like an overdose, but no, they, yeah.
That there's also statistics about that. In the work that I do trying to advocate for men's mental health and talk about men's mental health, because I think it's really integrated with the fight for trans liberation, the fight for queer liberation, the fight for women, because the other side of it is often, like you said, angry, mostly white men.
Yeah.
And the anger, I think, is protecting pain, right? It's protecting grief, it's protecting loss, it's protecting jealousy. Yeah. And one of the other, you know, statistics that's out there is that men now have less friends than they did 30 years ago. They are more likely to commit suicide if they don't have friends and they don't have a partner. Both of those things are really integral. Oh, the job loss, like you said, and they're much more likely to use lethal weapons that are going to succeed. So if we look at that context in the work that you're doing with your clients, and obviously I'm not trying to dig on any specifics, but I'm curious kind of what you've seen that's productive. What have you seen that's, I mean, we're saying that the sort of anger, the pain, the, you know, job loss being contributing to pain, that's consistent. What else is consistent and what helps?
So there are two things. One is just, you got to accept reality, right? Like, I think you got to see it. I like to compare it to the Magna Carta, right? When 1,000 years ago, it's almost literally 1,000 years ago, the Magna Carta was signed where royals had to accept that they have to share the world and resources, right? That the King of England doesn't own all of England, right? That has started, or I mean, it was the, I don't know what the right word is, but since then royals have really declined, right? Mm-hmm. The King of England today has almost no power compared to 1,000 years ago, right?
Right.
I think we're at a similar point for cisgender white men where like, yeah, you just have to acknowledge we don't run everything, right? You gotta share. There's one other side to that argument, which is the Malthusian argument, right? There used to be this idea that there's a fixed amount of resources.
Right, right.
And if you gotta basically take resources from someone else to have some, which it turns out is bullshit, right?
Mm. Scarcity mindset.
Exactly, right? So what helps is understanding that you and we, and if we actually work together, you can actually create a better world, right? A story that has more voices is actually a better story, and it actually is more interesting. And so a typical example is, without being specific, obviously someone comes here who was previously very successful in Hollywood, now can't get a job in Hollywood anymore, right? Because they're less, right? Cisgender white men cast, or they're less in, you know. And so to help be like, hey, not every film should be with a cisgender white male in the lead role, because we've seen 1,000 of those, right? And to understand there can be really interesting stories where you're just a side role, right? And that story might actually, you might overall, let's say you previously had a movie that sold, you know, made $100 million with you in the lead. Now, if you have a movie that makes $1 billion where you're just a supporting, you might actually make more off of it. You know, obviously it depends on the contract and all that. But the idea is that the cooperation actually leads to something.
Right.
So that's the one thing. But that's still in the mindset of that money and fame is the currency you're trying to get.
So the next thing is shifting the currency.
Shifting the currency right. to the real interesting currency mm-hmm. is the connection, right? And that is so hard. That's so hard for many men who were just in power, and their way to connect was, look how powerful I am. Now please respect me and love me. I'm never going to ask you to love me because I'm too hard for that. Secretly, I'm saying, please love me. But I'm really saying, look how good I am.
Right.
Right. Yeah. To say, hey, let's be good together, right? And let's, maybe we can do something even better than I could have done on my own. Maybe we can co-create. But that journey takes.
That's what I want to know about, though, because that's what I think about a lot in being in a men's team. Well, actually, a good example is when you and I first met, the way that we connected was by externalizing connection, right? Through swimming.
Yeah.
And there's nothing inherently wrong with that, I don't think. But if that's the only way we know how to connect, if that's the only, like, what if I wasn't fast? What if I hadn't been able to keep up with you?
Yeah.
Then I wouldn't maybe have been able to connect with you at all. One of the things I've observed is that if there isn't that external ability, way to externalize a connection with men specifically, it's very difficult to form that connection. And I want to know how we get through that, because I think as somebody who spent the first 18 years of my life walking the world, mostly being perceived as a woman and being socialized as a woman, there are also difficulties with making friends with women. Don't get me wrong, but it's different. Yeah. And you are expected to talk more about your feelings. You are expected to connect and say, I love you, give a hug. And I have very consciously dragged those sort of norms for myself into my manhood because I want them here. And I want to be able to tell my friends I care about them, to tell them that I love them, to ask them about what's really going on in their lives. And I've seen it help men around me, right? My friends who are guys watch me do it and they step into it.
Right.
But somebody has to do that.
Like there has to be a man who does it first, right? Right,
exactly. Like, and a man they respect.
Right.
Because if it's not, then it's a problem.
Right. If that's the thing, that's the social hierarchy thing. I think if the omega in the group, right, alpha to omega, if the omega does it, it's almost like, what the fuck?
Right.
But if the alpha does it, right, then it's like, oh, that's what we're going to do now.
Right.
But I do think there are, and stop me if this is more too much of a soapbox, right? But I do think there are four tasks we as men have to accomplish. Okay, and you can be like, hey, this
no,
is
no, I want right, this right? is exactly yeah, I want him. Tell me.
And I think we have to be magician, we have to be warrior, we have to be lover, and we have to be king. And if we're and in those, right, that gets very complicated, right? But just remember magician, warrior, lover, king. Okay. If you're warrior. Too much of a magician, you're a manipulator. If you're not enough of a magician, you're one of those guys who says, oh, I don't have anything to do with that. Right? If you're too much of a warrior, you're a sadist. If you're not enough of a warrior, you're a masochist. If you're too much of a lover, you're an addict. If you're not enough of a lover, you're impotent. If you're too much of a king, you're a tyrant. If you're not enough of a king, you're a weakling. So I look at it as these four tightropes that we constantly have to walk. And it's fun. It's scary and it's really, really fragile. I do think this currency of masculinity is really fragile. But if you follow that, like magician, warrior, lover, king, it helps me.
I like that a lot, especially the more you explain it, because what I'm hearing is actually balance. Most of that to me is balance, right? It's actually not being the magician all the time or the warrior all the time or the lover, right? It's actually not wholeheartedly assuming every stereotype that we might assign to those things. It's actually finding where the balance is so that we can kind of hold all of those things.
Right. Right. That, and that's the hard thing. Like, how the fuck do you balance that?
So that is the question. And I think, you know, we could probably do a whole series of podcasts about this, but I'm thinking about a specific person, and I won't say any more details. So I don't want to name them, but I'm thinking about a specific person in my life who's a cisgender man. And I feel like I can see how in pain he is because he's not the man he thinks he's supposed to be. And my transition was very disruptive to him because my manhood and my ability to say this is my manhood was like, okay, well, then what about my manhood? If you can just say that you're a man, well, what does that mean about my? And he didn't verbalize this to me, but I could happening. No, never. And I think it came out in small ways. It came out in anger. It was very clear to me that that was the struggle. But I could see, you know, I think at the beginning I felt pain. I was like, this is painful to me. I'm not being, you know, seen as myself. I'm not being received. I'm not being loved in this moment. But what I saw from him as I was able to pull back from how I felt because of him, I saw that he was in pain. And it was all about how he couldn't hold his own masculinity and protect his own masculinity while also experiencing mine. What do you say to that guy? How do we invite him in? Because this is going to be, you know, maybe an intense way to say this, but those are the guys that go end up shooting schools. Those are the guys who end up killing themselves. Those are the guys that end up, you know, raping and assaulting people.
Oh yeah.
Those are the guys that are hurting themselves first and then other people.
Yeah.
And I want to know, what do we do about that?
That's the question.
I don't know if we can answer it.
I mean, look, you gotta answer it. For me, it's very binary. The first question I have to figure out is, are they a danger to themselves or others? If they are, I have to contain them. You know, it's just, I'm sorry, there is, like, if they're an active danger,
right,
then I'm sorry, I'm using force, you know, to contain them. If there's someone who strikes me, I'm going to defend myself. If there's someone who threatens to strike me and I actually believe it, right, it's pretty rare that happens,
right? But
then I call the police, you know. And I guess that's a whole nother discussion, but I'm white, a male, and the police comes and helps me, right? Mm-hmm. If they're a danger to themselves, right, then obviously that's a classic therapy session. But if I cannot contain them in the time that I'm able to give them, then I have to hospitalize them.
Right.
So that's always the first thing. Are they actively a danger to themselves or others? Then the immediate answer is containment, right? If they're not an immediate danger, but a potential one, right, then the really, really precarious process of community comes in, of resourcing, of helping them understand, like, what are they really looking for, right, versus what do they think they're looking for. Like, for me, I don't know if you want to include
this. Yeah, please, I want to hear about you.
Example is, I used to think that in order to be a man, I always have to have the most powerful erection. Right. Sometimes, you know, I can't, right? As it turns out, you know, like, especially I'm tired, exhausted, and my wife wants to have sex, and I'm just like, fuck, I'm exhausted. I can't, you know? And this is like embarrassing. I'm like embarrassed right now to admit this to you, right?
Thank you for telling me.
It's like, fuck, you know? But for me to admit that, yes, I want to be a man, but what I really want is to be held. Like, it took me probably 500 hours of therapy just to get to the point to say, I want to be held. Because what I said for at least 15 years before that was, I want to demonstrate my power. Right. And to be like, oof, I gotta admit that I need the other side of it. I need to feel that, to allow that to. And then there's something really, really special. That's why I also love sports and love contact sports, of feeling the power of a fellow man, right? I do think, actually, this is a bias, right? But I do think almost everyone's bisexual. So I do think it doesn't just have to be in sports. It can be in wonderful, loving environments that can be sensual and sexual. But the safest place is sports, right? The safest place
especially for men who are not self-proclaimed as queer or bisexual, like you said.
There is the, when you're in that space where you can feel the power of another man, it actually makes almost every man that I know feel safe. Mm. Right. So I will take someone who's actively like a super aggressive, really on the verge of being an acute danger to someone else. Mm-hmm. I will take him to the ring. And I'm lucky to work with the UFC. So I have a lot of connections there. And I call one of my friends, assuming I can't take him myself. And I'm not that strong with some of these guys. Like, they're really, really strong. Right. Especially if they're in a rage and they're in steroids, right. You really got to be careful. So, but none of these guys is someone that a UFC fighter can't handle. Right. So they go in the ring, they fight it out. And then 10 out of 10 times, this is just, I shouldn't say my favorite part of my work, but it's so beautiful to see. That's when they're able to let the pain and the tears out. When they've just like beaten each other up for an hour, right? And they felt the powerful embrace of someone else, right? Who they cannot harm, but they can try, right? And then they sweat together, they bleed together, then they hug together, and then they cry together. And then it's like, oh, that's the first connection.
You know what it makes me think of? That was so powerful. I was like riveted the entire time. I it makes me think of, bear with me, a child screaming, having a tantrum, crying, throwing things, breaking things, yelling, "Mom, I hate you," and then breaking into tears and actually being upset because something bad happened at school, or they lost a race, or dad died, you know. It makes me think of that sort of raw, like,
exactly what it is.
Yeah. And what the core of that actually is not, I mean, kids are like that because they haven't learned how to emotionally regulate. And men are like that because they
haven't learned to emotionally regulate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And what I think about, all the things that you said, we could spend hours talking about. I love what you talked about in terms of like the safety of competition, the safety of sport that allows you to, like you said earlier, say like, "Fuck you, let's go," kind of thing, which is both love and fight. Mm-hmm. But in a
it's
safety,
warrior and lover and king.
Exactly. Right? It's actually in the most sort of tame way, erotic in a sense. It's this mm-hmm. ability to say, "I love you and we're going to fight." It's going to be rough and it's going to be sex. It's going to be really getting into
it's going to be intimate.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's going to be okay at the end. And I think that's the core. That's the safety that underlines it all.
Yeah.
That's so powerful to think about. How do we do that? I mean, this is, you don't have to answer this question, but I'm just sort of musing. How do we do that without having to fight, right? Is there an earlier intervention? And if so, what is it?
So I haven't found one because I tell you, my older son, first of all, I was that child, right? The tantruming, and I didn't have the father there, right? And my older son had huge tantrums. Right. And he is very powerful. And as you can probably imagine, schools in LA, they're very afraid to get sued. So the teachers and the staff there actually have to hold back their power. So there were a couple situations where he, as a 5-year-old, overpowered the teacher. Right. And I had to really talk with him. And you can't really talk to a 5-year-old in a tantrum. Right. So what I would do is I would just be with him. I would just be with him for sometimes, like hours at a time, and sometimes aggressively hold him like a straitjacket, right? Until he calmed down, you know? And now he's this unbelievable, amazing young child. When he like gives presentations, you know, he's in kindergarten, right? But he gives presentations to like LAUSD, which is our local school district, on like how to handle tantrums, right? And it's like, but there was a real period of time where I was like, fuck, what do I do? You know, and the only thing I could think of is when he's being dangerous, right? When he threatens his younger sibling or his mother, right? To just contain him, hold him. So I have not, I have not found a better way that when it gets to that dangerous point, that it's that physical containment. I know there's this, I mean, the ideal solution, find a way, right? I mean, there is, the research is coming out and it's getting very convincing that some psychedelic therapy helps, right? Like MDMA, although it's not legal, right? Not legal yet, not legal in California especially, it does amazing things. Like the research looks very promising to allow to switch into para, right? This is, it's really an over, what it really is, right, is an overactive sympathetic nervous system response, right? And you need to activate the parasympathetic nervous system. And the way to do that sometimes is with medications. And my understanding of the research and some experience is that that MDMA and later treatment stages, that also psilocybin can really, really help with that.
I'm thinking about you containing your kid, giving him this big hug, and how the pain, the anger, whether it be of a 5-year-old boy threatening his teacher, or a, you know, a 25-year-old man coming into a school and shooting it up. The base need is actually that intimacy. It's that need to be held, and yeah, no idea how to ask for that. And not even no idea how to ask for it, a clear message from most men in most boys' lives that says, absolutely, you cannot ask for it, right? Yeah. It's the explicit message that says, boys, don't cry, man up, don't be a girl, right? Yeah. What have you? And I think it's so beautiful that that is your answer. I think you're right. It's not an answer that necessarily extrapolates, you know, or can be like a treatment method of go and have every man be hugged. But also, maybe every man just needs to be hugged, you know?
I think that's, you know, that's... I think there is this like fighting or like sweating together with another man, I think really helps. Mm. I think just that the endorphins that are released, the connections that are released, and especially in combat sports or in contact sports, right, where you feel the physical power, right, and you exhaust yourself, right? I do think it just biologically, right, that eventually the norepinephrine and epinephrine and, you know, adrenaline, right, that's that drives the sympathetic nervous system gets depleted, right? And then it's easier for the serotonin and dopamine to get released, right? And then eventually, if you're really good and if you're really lucky, some oxytocin, right, the cuddling gets released too. Sure. Then why do boxers hug after a fight? Because they want to. You know?
And I think, and the crucial part is, this is not fighting to kill somebody on the street. This is in a contained situation, right? We're not actually going to war when we compete in swimming or when people are, you know, it looks violent on UFC, but we know the goal is actually not to kill the person.
Right.
And I think that's a key part of it too, because that undergirding of safety.
And I do think, by the way, that's exactly the interesting thing is what you said, and this is dark to say, but the school shooter is looking for intimacy. And if you think about the moment in a UFC fight where one man or one fighter has to surrender to the other, that's actually an incredibly intimate moment for both.
Right. Yeah.
And I think that is incredibly helpful for masculine development.
That moment where you can allow it, essentially.
Right. And give it, right? The other side, right?
Yeah.
The giving too. That's like, it satisfied a basic narcissistic need. Mm. Not a narcissistic, like clinical personality disorder, but just the need of like,
feeding the ego.
Yeah.
But I think I hear it in sort of two ways, where it's that, and it's this, goes back to the respect, right? And the humanity portion, where it says, actually, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, a UFC fight, two guys, one guy wins, the other guy doesn't. And there is that moment where you have to then surrender that loss. And there is a mutual respect, it seems, I think, in the moment that you're saying, that this ideal moment, there is a respect. It says, I see you even though I've beat you. I've been beaten and I see you.
Yeah.
Right. And there's that's shared. That's what you're talking about, right?
Exactly. It's exactly like an Avatar. You know that movie when one animal gets killed and then the killer says, I see you, and you're going to now feed my family.
Right.
That's exactly what happens in the UFC fights, right?
It's value. It says, I value you and all that you've put forth in this fight. I think that, that's really beautiful. I want to ask you this. You don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but I want to sort of dig a little bit. Earlier, you got very emotional as you were talking about your kid, and I was I feel really grateful to be able to witness that, that you feel safe, or just that you shared that emotion with me. In this conversation, we're talking about being able to be vulnerable, finding intimacy with other men. What do you think has allowed you to be able to show that kind of emotion in this moment with me? Or just in your life?
Well, the simple answer is it feels good, right? It just, like, I don't want to hide that from you. And the other is, I don't think I have to prove my masculinity to you or really to anyone. There was a big part of my life where I walked around accusing every man who cried to be a weakling, right? I do think the opposite is the case. Mm. I think a man who doesn't cry is a weakling. And also it gets, like, if you're looking just at clinical scales, it gets very dangerous if someone wants to cry but can't, right? That's one of the indicators of suicide, right? Of, like, a pending suicide attempt.
Right.
I mean, there were many times where I was ashamed, you know?
How did you build the self-confidence? And I mean, I know you said years and years of therapy, but can you, like, if there's another man who's listening to this, who is, you know, looks up to you, is hearing your ability to access that emotion, but is so afraid to do it himself, what would you have wanted to hear? What would help you in that moment?
What I would say is, try happy tears first.
Mm.
That's the first one. That's like, because it takes a lot to get to happy tears, right? Try those first, you know, see how they feel. Then hopefully someone you love at some point in your life will die. Go to the funeral, you know, because there are these few, like, sanctioned places where men are allowed to cry, right? Mm-hmm. So a funeral, great, you know? And I do encourage anyone I work with that if you have a chance to be with someone who you love and who loves you at the moment of their death, like literally at the moment of last breath, I highly encourage it, because it's really, really a special, again, an intimate moment, right? The other, so that's the happy tears, but those are kind of hard to get to. The other ones are angry tears, right? And again, that's where the fighting really helps, right? Like, get really angry, so angry that you want to cry and scream and again, right, overpower the sympathetic nervous system to the point where it's so depleted that the parasympathetic can take over and the tears can come out, right? So there is a way, right? I'm sorry, I wish I had a better answer.
No, I think yeah. It's a great answer. I love what you said about the happy tears as well. I know for me, sometimes when I feel like I can't cry about things I'm sad about or angry about, because sometimes those, I feel like I have more difficult time accessing those. Yeah. This is my embarrassing thing, I guess, but I'll watch like auditions for America's Got Talent or American Idol. Yeah, and anytime, yeah. You know, that kid gets their dream, yeah, and they're getting the buzzer, yeah, eyeball. I can't handle it. I just start crying.
Yeah.
And then as I'm crying, usually it becomes about other things too. I start feeling all these other things, and it's not just happy tears. It's also grieving tears. It's also sad tears. It's also angry tears. It like all seems to come out, but I need to like flick the switch. And so
by the way, speaking please. Of flipping the switch, yeah. I'm interrupting you kind of rudely, is that music really helps.
Mm.
Like some music is just really, really good.
That's so true. Yeah. Especially music that has like nostalgia hooked into it. That's sometimes I cry harder than I have like ever cried with certain songs. So I'm sure you have similar experiences, but so when I, well, maybe not the specific one, but before I transitioned, I was perceived as a woman, right? Mm-hmm. And as I was perceived as a woman, especially on a co-ed team in high school, I was often, I'm going to say the shortest way, the object of misogyny, right? The object of boys in a swimsuit, right?
Yeah.
And people said a lot of uncomfortable things about my body. At one point, I was told that my brother didn't want to shower in the bathroom because they talked so much about my body and what they wanted to do with it at the time. So there's a lot of like inappropriate comments essentially about my body, which I'm not surprised by, but it was a lot. So I went from that, and then I walked into the men's locker room a year later.
Right.
And as what people then perceived as a man.
Yeah.
And the same comments were there. The same, locker room talk was there. It wasn't about me anymore, but it was about my friends and about people I knew.
Yeah.
And what I found was, first of all, I was shocked, uncomfortable, and didn't really know how to interact in those moments. But one of the things I found as I kind of was a fly on the wall. Like I tried really hard to just kind of pay attention, figure out
learn the code.
Exactly. Yeah. I was trying to figure out how can I be here? If I want to change it, how do I learn it first? Right.
Right. Right.
And one of the most, I think, eye-opening things I noticed was that everybody was performing for each other. And it wasn't, there were no women in the locker room. There was no girls. Yeah, and most of the guys on my team are straight. Yeah. There's a couple queer ones too, but most of them were straight. They're all interested in women. There are no women in that locker room. They are performing for no women. They are only performing for themselves.
Yep.
And that was a big like, whoa moment for me when I first recognized it. And I would watch all, especially the younger guys, look to the older guys as they said something dumb, you know, being like, who's going to laugh at my joke, you know? And I at first I was bothered by it. I was like, this is so stupid. Like, who are you performing for? Why the other guys? And then it hit me. And this is when I got sad. And I was like, you're looking to belong. Like, just like I want to be here to belong, you're doing the same thing. But you've been taught for longer that the way that you belong is by assuming this toxic masculinity. And you're really asking, like you said earlier, for people to love you.
Well, I think there's yes, and they're also looking to establish and refine social hierarchy, right? I do think, yes, the primary is like, I want to belong in this group. And then where do I rank in this group?
Right.
Like who gets the biggest laughs or who gets the biggest awe?
Do you remember the moment when, or a moment, a time, could you tell us a story about a time when you sort of saw that happening and that performing for each other?
Oh, it happens constantly, right? Well, for the longest time, I was just in it thinking that's the way, right? That was so without any claim or any inkling of self-awareness, right? So,
well, I think that's fairly common, especially because most men are taught this is how it is,
right?
This is how it has to be. This is how you belong.
Right.
And they're explicitly told also, if you don't do this, you won't belong. If you don't you're a coward. If you don't, So it makes a ton of sense that people assume that this is just the way it is. But when did you realize that it was kind of sort of a construction that people were all playing this game silently agreeing to play the game too?
I see it most obvious with cars. That's one where it's like the guys who put the Ferrari key on the lunch table. that's one where I'm just really, I get sad to see because men, as they get older, right, they at some point stop competing with their bodies because it gets very embarrassing for them, right? And they start competing with their money, and that gets really cruel when it's like get egged on to make these purchases of these status symbols, that because that can ruin a guy,
right?
I mean, the most painful moment was probably when I was yelling at my sister, trying to defend this kind of masculine behavior. I said, that's just how men are. I'd seen it so often. And then I still see it. Right? I still see it in many of my friend groups. I think you're inspiring me for me to maybe speak out more about that. I don't think I think sometimes I like play with it, right? Then there's another part of me that also likes, because I often end up at the top of that hierarchy, right? And other times I actually use my ability to maneuver in that hierarchy to connect with these angry young men.
Yeah.
But I don't think I do enough to really change the culture, right? I think I could speak up more in these locker rooms.
Using it as a ticket to connect, I think is the primary way I see it, right? I wasn't steeped in it, I think, the same way that you were, because I didn't grow up being perceived as a boy. I wasn't socialized as a boy, especially not by my parents. Boyhood was always just out of reach, right? Just close enough that I couldn't have it. And I think I watched it then from the sidelines, right?
Yeah.
And as I watched it, for me, I think I was able to see, okay, this is how I connect. And my first year on the team, I almost left. I almost left the men's team. It was actually preseason. We hadn't even begun.
Yeah.
And it was my first day on the team. I was getting misgendered by a lot of people, and that was incredibly painful, especially being on the men's team. I just felt off. I felt different. People were making comments about lots of things that made me feel uncomfortable, and I'd never been in a men's team before.
Yeah.
Right. And I almost left. I literally called my mom. I said, please come pick me up. I'm leaving. I can't do this. We haven't even started. I haven't even had the first meet.
Yeah.
And I actually want to thank goodness, at that place, there was somebody's dad who's a psychologist and he pulled me aside and he said, you're not going to make any change if you leave, you have to stay and you have to get them to connect with you first. You can't just go yelling at everybody, which I wasn't, but he knew that's what I felt. And he was like, if you yell at them, you're going to break that connection. Figure out how to connect and then make a difference.
And I would add one painful component. What I think really helped you is you got to beat at least one of them.
Yes.
Right.
I mean, that's the respect piece we started this conversation with.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I didn't beat anybody that first year.
Yeah.
I didn't. I got last place at my last meet. Yeah. And, or my champ, my whatever, my taper meet that year. And I waited. I waited to make a lot of the changes that I wanted. And I think, I guess the reason that I'm saying this, you were mentioning wanting to do more. I think that's awesome. And I think that would be great if you could find ways to insert, you know, these kinds of mm-hmm. conversations with people, but they have to trust you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of like, I always teeter on this edge of how do I beat one guy enough mm-hmm. to earn the respect mm-hmm. so that I can then say, we actually don't need to play this game this way. Right. Yeah. And it's one of those tense lines. Like you mentioned the warrior and the lover and the king and the magician, it's the same tense line of balance to find. And I find it really hard to find that balance.
Well, so I have kind of a shortcut here.
Okay.
Hack is that, because where that really exists is exactly where you say it exists, in the ego structure. Ego structure is neurologically, right, in the prefrontal cortex, and is basically gamma-aminobutyric acid, GABA, right?
Yeah.
The GABA receptors. If you can attack those, you can actually experience a man without his ego, which is one of the most beautiful things mm-hmm. you'll ever see. Well, that's a big statement, but it's a wonderful, intimate...
Within masculinity, definitely one of the most beautiful things to see.
And there are a couple ways to do it. One is exhaustion, like we talked about. The other is breath work. Right. If you do a specific breathwork technique, you can actually
like
induce
Wim Hof or something like.
No. It's Wim Hof is more like to maximize lung capacity. This is more holotropic breathing. It's very similar to that, where you induce like a transient hyperprefrontality. Right. Where you induce a temporary moment where the brain gets undersupplied, and just shuts down the air supply from the ego, right? And it's amazing.
Right.
It lasts, it's not dangerous, right? And nothing's ever happened in that, right? It lasts about 10, 15 minutes, right? And that's why I think a lot of men seek the drugs, right? A lot of drugs do that.
Well, I think a lot of the most beautiful connection conversations I've had with men have been at a party, you know, and they will tell me things that I have never heard them say before that are so honest, so emotional. Yeah, I've had guys cry and say the most amazing things, honestly, to me, while intoxicated, because like you said, their GABA is inhibited and they're connecting with themselves without that ego sitting on top of it. I want to know how we can get more men to do that, because I hear the amount of work it's taken for you to do that. Yeah. I know for me, it's work as well. I've been in a lot of therapy, and it's coming from a different socialization. I think that's a huge part of it, which is why I love that I'm transgender. I love all mm-hmm. the things I've learned from being trans. I think that's a shortcut to mm-hmm. learning a lot of this stuff. But, you know, we unfortunately have to wrap up this conversation, and I don't want to, because I think this is the stuff that you're sharing about men specifically is the stuff we are in such dire need of this conversation, and the expertise that you're sharing. Many men, white, cisgender, straight men specifically, feel left out. And they are being left out, right? Because they've been so prioritized for so long, they're being left out. Yeah. So validly so. And that young little boy or 15-year-old boy or 25-year-old boy doesn't know why, doesn't know how, and doesn't know what to do. So you've been that boy in moments, mm-hmm. in sort of wrapping up this conversation. Is there any, you know, last thing that you would say to a young boy now who's feeling that tension, who's feeling that anger, mm-hmm. other than giving him a big hug and containing him, what else would you want him to know?
There's the hard part. I do think there's a hard message of like, sorry, the world is moving on and you're not going to be the natural king anymore. Right. Sorry. That's just a reality you got to accept. That's the first part. And the second is, okay, how can we, if you accept that reality, if you're willing to accept that, then stop following Andrew Tate, right? start looking for men who are able to be vulnerable and who you don't consider sissies. Mm. Right? Because oftentimes, right, the moment a man is vulnerable, his currency, right, his masculinity chip is like lost. But there are few who actually gain, you know, who actually, and I think that's the big change of the tides, that man who's not able to be vulnerable is dying out, right? And then I will end it again, and I'm kind of harsh with some of these men. I would end it with the harsh truth that eventually you will also become old and weak. Like, sorry, you cannot beat time, right? Or like they like to hear, you cannot beat father time, right? Eventually you will be old and weak, and by then you better have figured it out.
I like the sandwich. It's like a reality, a softness. Find what feeds you, right? That vulnerability is about actually what nourishes me. And then another really important reality of this, you don't have forever. This kind of brings us back to how you started with explaining yourself. You didn't name Olympian. You didn't name Ferrari owner. You didn't name, you know, your status symbols. You said, I do this work to be a good father and a good lover and a good husband. And those are things that will stand the test of time, right? Those aren't going to go away, whereas all the other things could. And I think that I really appreciate that perspective shift. And I think something that I want to keep thinking about as well is how can I center on who I want to be in the world and what nourishment I need from the world, which a lot of it is actually intimacy from people around me.
Oh yeah.
Marcus, thank you so much for this conversation. I feel like I've learned so much, and I know listeners are going to grow immeasurably from this as well.
Thank you. I'm grateful to you. I'm grateful to walk the world with men like you.
Thank you so much to Dr. Rogan for his time and his vulnerability. I absolutely teared up so many times during that conversation. Maybe you did as well. And we know that Dr. Rogan had his own tears. And I so appreciated being able to walk into that conversation with him. As you heard, we have shared several swim practices together, and that has created this bond, but it was really lovely to actually bring that to a conversation that I could then share with you all. So let's address the question directly. What should we do with all of these angry white men? Of course, like pretty much every question we ask here on Dear Skyler, there isn't an easy answer. And I think with this conversation specifically, it's a very delicate and careful balance that we have to strike. One of the things I think a lot is that toxic masculinity, these expectations that men are emotionless, only can exhibit anger or violence, are supposed to suppress their feelings, are supposed to maintain a sort of a hard stoic exterior, right? Toxic masculinity hurts men first, and then they hurt others with the same pain. And it's not to say that men are oppressed, and it's important to understand this distinction, right? Oppression is the combination of prejudice and power, and because we live in a patriarchal world, that empowers men over women, gives men power over women, men are not experiencing oppression because they're not experiencing that combination of prejudice and power, but men are suffering greatly. Here are a few facts to consider. According to a 2022 Gallup survey, the percentage of men with at least 6 close friends fell by half between 1990 and 2021. 1 in 5 single men say they have no close friendships, and research shows that social isolation can weaken the immune system and cause people to suffer from a variety of ailments, as well as the fact that mental health experts link this growing isolation that American men experience to societal violence. Think about the 330 plus mass shootings we've had just this year, largely committed by white men. If we take this in consideration with the fact that men are also less likely than women to share their personal feelings and receive emotional support, they're less likely to say "I love you" to their friends, and men stifled by traditional gender norms are 7 times more likely to use physical violence and twice as likely than men who are not stifled by gender norms to have suicidal thoughts, we're having a crisis here, right? A men's mental health crisis. And this might surprise you as it did me, but the rate of suicide in this country is highest among middle-aged white men. So I think it's crucial to take all of this into consideration as we're thinking about the answer to the question that Dr. Rogan and I talked about. Having emotional conversations between two men, being able to connect with passion, with vulnerability, with intensity, as well as Dr. Rogan and I spoke about, is key to walking through these difficulties. But I think if we zoom out a bit from even just me and Dr. Rogan having a conversation, and maybe even, you know, me and my teammates or me and my guy friends, but we have to also zoom out from these individual interactions and look at the stigma, the systemic issues that are causing men, and specifically going back to the top of this podcast, young boys that feel that they have to be a man a certain way in order to be respected, in order to feel that they can be accepted. And as you heard us talk about in the podcast, a lot of engagement in these harmful behaviors, this toxic masculinity, is about needing to belong, wanting to be loved. And so I want to recommend to you as an answer to this question that in your life, no matter who you are, you can help welcome the emotions of men around you and, if you're a man, within yourself. I think that's the most powerful and accessible answer that we can give here in regards to what we do with all of these angry white men, but it's going to take bigger systemic changes as well, which requires all of us to step in to this conversation. And it's going to take even bigger changes beyond that, right? It's going to take teaching young boys that when we talk about feminism, it doesn't mean that men aren't important or don't exist. It means that we're trying to make sure that resources are equally allocated, right? To address the multiple millennia where men have been empowered and women haven't. I think it's going to take a lot of education, a lot of great conversations, and a lot of also men standing up and saying, I'm willing to be a feminist. I'm willing to step into my own emotions. And let me show you that it's okay for you to do so too. Men can be soft, men can have emotions, men can be so much more than we are taught to be. And if we invite these things in as we talk about all kinds of social justice, I think we'll have a better world.